Thanks very much for joining me. I'm Bob Franklin. You're listening to the Public Affairs Program, Like It Is. Today we have an interesting conversation with the author of the book, A Medical Apartheid, The Dark Side of Medical Experimentation on Black Americans from Colonial Times to the Present. She's Harriet A. Washington. Before we bring Ms. Washington on board with our interview, I want to read an excerpt from her book, which is will set the tone for our conversation today. It's an excerpt taken from page 10 of her book, and it reads, "It was cheaper to use niggers than cats because they were everywhere and cheap experimental animals," neurosurgeon Harry Bailey reminisced in a 1960s speech he delivered while at Tulane University. Very provocative statement, but I guess he believed that at the time. Joining me from New York, Ms. Washington, the author of Medical Apartheid. How you doing?
Just fine. How are you?
I'm very well. Let's delve into particularly that comment, how it came about, how did you find it, and then we'll talk about your book, why you wrote it, and why it's important.
Well, of course, that comment is quite shocking in its frankness, but I did find that although most researchers were not so open about their animus toward black people, you still did find, even as late as 1995, a smattering of researchers who were just inveterate and naked racists who were very, very open about their opinion that the proper role for African-Americans in the research laboratory is as subjects. Thomas Morell said almost the same thing in a slightly more moderated tone about the Tuskegee syphilis experiment. And then Dr. Clarence Lushbaugh in 1995 very openly said that he and his partner, Eugene Sanger, had used black patients at the University of Cincinnati in their radiation experiments because these people are black and poor and they're poorly washed and they were available to us. So there is this mentality, sometimes openly stated and sometimes somewhat repressed, that black people are appropriate medical subjects because they're somehow worthless than whites.
Well, let's walk back a bit to colonial times, because in your book you use examples of colonial times when there was very little, if any, regard for use for blacks as subjects. Talk a little bit about what you found as it relates to blacks in medical treatment during that period.
Well, from the colonial era and then a bit later in the antebellum era and through the Victorian age, of course, black people, the vast majority of black people in this country were enslaved. The vast majority of black people in this country lived in the South in the antebellum period. We're talking about 90% of the populace. So we have a situation where the political and economic of enslavement were mirrored in the medical arena. You had physicians who were treating black people exactly as if they were medical slaves. And there were many, many factors, probably too many to go into in a brief radio interview, that contributed to this. But one very important set of factors was a set of beliefs about the bodies and intelligence of black people. These beliefs were promulgated by the American School of Ethnology, and that means these were doctors like Josiah Nott, Dr. Samuel Cartwright, George Glidden. These physicians said that black people were so profoundly different from white people that often they said that they were a different species, but they always said that we were profoundly inferior. Deformed bodies, unintelligent minds, very poor judgment. They also found differences that made black people perfect research subjects. The same things that made us the perfect laborers in the hot, malarious climates of the South made black people good research subjects. They said that we didn't feel pain the way white people did. They said that we had been dictated by the Creator to serve white people, and white physicians took this to mean that black bodies should be available to them to further medical knowledge. So that you had a whole mentality from the beginning that viewed black people as appropriate medical subjects, as not quite human, and of possessed of qualities that meant that physicians didn't have esteem them in the same way. During the Victorian era, where sexual chastity was very important, black women were held to be, for example, very unchaste, you know, very sexually profligate. They called black women inappropriate Jezebels. And these beliefs made it easier to use black women to perfect reproductive surgeries. Most of the gynecologic surgeries in the antebellum period in this country were perfected using the bodies of enslaved women and also free black women.
We have so much to cover. I almost don't know where to start. Let's talk about today, the mindset. We'll go back and forth, but today, how has this particular mindset, or has this a mindset been created by African Americans that makes them skeptical about going to physicians?
Well, sure. I mean, a lot of studies have validated, in fact, every important study except for one, and that study is frankly quite illogical. Every important study that's valuable states that black people fear medical care and especially fear medical research. On a purely anecdotal level, most medical researchers will bemoan the fact that they have a hard time getting black people to enroll. And this is a direct consequence of this ugly history, because even though your average black person, of course, does not know about the details of the history in my book, but the memory of medical abuse, especially in a research setting, has been preserved in African Americans in oral history. Even today, I'm sure most of us have older relatives who have told us, you know, horror stories about the treatment of themselves or somebody else in the hospital. So that it's perfectly logical in one sense for black people to have a fear of medical research, because after all, we have been abused, we have been treated disparately, and there's never been an acknowledgement of that. There's only been an acknowledgement of the one study that took place in Alabama when the United States Public Health Service experimented on black Alabama sharecroppers with syphilis. That's the only study that's ever been acknowledged. All the others have been ignored, and I think that's common sense. You have to, I mean, anyone can understand that if someone abuses you and then denies it, you're not going to trust that person. That's the situation we have today. Of course, the abuses today are a lot more subtle. There were horrible things done in the past that don't happen today by and large, but there's still abuses, there's still the potential for abuse, so we still have to be careful today.
Could you give an example of a subtlety that you just mentioned that may be occurring today?
Yes. In the antebellum and even the colonial period, the belief that black people had a very different physiology from white people meant that the drugs and medications they were given were different than those given whites, and the treatments they were given were different from those treated whites. They didn't work particularly well. They were stereotyped based on race. Today, I fear that in one sense we're seeing a return to the stereotyped neo-racial medicine. If you look at the heart drug, Bidal, which was approved not too long ago for use only in black people, that's a very good example of a drug that was poorly tested, very illogically tested, on the base of very shoddy research. It was approved for black people. It's nonsense. This is not a black drug, even though the FDA said that Bidal is a drug that can only be used for black people with congestive heart failure. It's not only for black people, but now it's being perceived that way by physicians and by the general public. This perception contributes to the opinion that black people have different bodies and need different medications. This is a difference that has never worked in our favor. And in this case, it is not predicated on good research. It's predicated on very poor research. And my fear is that we're going to see more and more of this. Another problem I can point to very readily is genetics. Genetics has always been a two-edged sword for African Americans. It's true that with genetics, there is we're going to be able to come up with better drugs, pharmacogenetics, and better treatments. But in terms of black people, genetics is being used more to validate the belief in the difference of black bodies. Although genetic is really exaggerated when it comes to black ailments. Fewer than 1 in 200 deaths among black people can be ascribed to genetic disorders. And yet, many, many research initiatives and many, many treatments stress genetics in devising them. And genetics just provides a biological underpinning for the centuries-old belief in black bodies being different. There are a lot of reasons why genetic research is not very important and is being overemphasized. But one very simple one anyone can understand is the fact that most of us don't know our genetic component. We don't, black people don't know our histories. We can't trace our genealogies back more than a few generations, most of us. We certainly don't know our original origins. And because of all the widespread black-white mixing, if you look at black people in this country, you see an entire rainbow in terms of appearance or phenotype. And if you were to look at the genetic complement, the genotype, you're going to see everything from black people, most of whose genes emanate from Europeans, to black people who have mostly genes from African and other sources. So, you know, I think that's a really good example of shoddy research that has the same mentality as antebellum research did.
Well, let's talk about research. Maybe it may turn out to be shoddy. The contraceptive or the birth patch, the patch that women would place on their arms as a contraceptive. I think you mentioned in your book about there was a school in Baltimore that was a target school that was used as an experimental school. Talk a little bit about that.
That actually wasn't the patch. That was Norplant.
Norplant.
Those were the implanted capsules, but they used the same medication, essentially. So what happened there was that Norplant was devised as five or six implanted capsules put in a woman's arm, left there for 5 years, during which time it's supposed to release enough contraceptive to protect her for pregnancy for 5 years. When Norplant was first put on the market, there was immediate reaction, including a very notorious editorial in the Philadelphia Inquirer that said, "Black, we need to put this implant this contraceptive in black women. Black women are having too many children, and black because they're having too many children, they're perpetuating black poverty. By implanting black women with Norplant, we can reduce the underclass." Now, there are many, many errors of fact in this statement, but it was absorbed wholesale. And very shortly after that, a lot of other editorials, a lot of medical people echoed the sentiment. And very shortly after that, they did indeed implant schoolgirls, young girls in Baltimore schools with Norplant. Now, the interesting thing is that choosing Baltimore was politically very, very savvy. Choosing Baltimore enabled them to promote a warped view of black women and teenage pregnancy, because Baltimore is atypical in that it's mostly black city and it has a very high teenage pregnancy rate. So by choosing Baltimore, they were able to try to make a case for this. And they implanted Norplant, this contraceptive, in young girls in school-based clinic. The school-based clinic collected data on the effectiveness of Norplant in young girls and its safety. Norplant had never been tested in girls this young before. So essentially, use in school-based clinics constituted a huge research experiment. And at the end, it turned out that Norplant had a slew of serious health problems. But young girls who were implanted with this and women who were implanted with this were mostly black, and Norplant was never accepted among middle-class women and white women before its many health hazards became public and it was withdrawn from the market. So essentially, this was a drug that turned out to be dangerous. It potentiated a lot of diseases. It wasn't appropriate for people who had diseases like hypertension and diabetes, and yet there are very high rates of these disorders in black women. So it was used in black women, and it was used in young girls as part of a research study, and it was never applied to black to white women. And this is actually a pattern with contraceptives. Depo-Provera, which was originally castigated for being a carcinogenic contraceptive, was tested in women of color and implanted largely in women of color, because very often these contraceptives are distributed through school-based clinics, Planned Parenthood clinics, and clinics that accept Medicaid, which guarantees they're going to be implanted in or given to low-income women and mostly women of color. So this has been a sad pattern in our country of testing risky contraceptives in black women, giving them to black women disproportionately, and then withdrawing them from the market before white women are also exposed to their dangers.
I just want to go back a little bit in time. In your book, you talked about the use of cadavers, black cadavers. Talk a little bit about that.
Yes, it's an especially disturbing trend, especially because during its heyday, the Victorian era, a dead body was treated differently than it is today. Today we see a dead body briefly in the funeral home or the hospital, but people used to die at home. And people imbued dead bodies with a great deal of social significance. You know, you carefully washed and dressed the body, you took postmortem photographs, you shared with your friends, and everyone, black and white, considered the treatment of dead bodies extremely important. For black people, it might have been even more important because there's a very strong African traditions that said not only should one treat the ancestors with respect, but they believed that ancestors who were disrespected could cause a lot of problems for the living, including sickness. So it was very hard for doctors to find bodies for anatomical dissection. At the beginning, that wasn't a huge problem because every doctor did not get a body. If you were a medical student, you watched your professor dissect the body. But as medical education changed, it became important for every physician to be able to say, I have dissected a body. I know the human body. And that's when a great need for cadavers came in. These cadavers came from black communities. Harriet Martineau, who was a London journalist, visited the United States, and she made a really interesting statement. She said, in Baltimore, the bodies of blacks are used for dissection because the whites do not like it, and the blacks cannot protest. And that really mirrored the situation throughout the South and eventually throughout the country, where it was black bodies that were taken. At first, they were taken from criminals, people who died under a double sentence of death and dissection. But that didn't supply enough bodies, and eventually, as I read newspaper accounts and I read medical journal articles, I found that there were legal devices enacted to make sure that the bodies used for dissection were black. For example, some laws actually stated that black criminals were executed, their bodies would be given to medical students. And they stipulated black criminals, not white. Medical students regularly raided black cemeteries because black people were buried in separate cemeteries for their bodies. And probably the most dramatic validation of this happened in 1995 when the Medical College of Georgia at Augusta was renovating its old anatomical laboratory. They wanted to turn it into a museum. And construction workers who broke into the basement found 9,800 human bones. A team of scientists, very diverse scientists, everything from anthropologists to nutritionists to physicians, examined the remains and determined that 3/4 of them were African American. And this situation was mirrored all the way across the country. And Dr. Montague Cobbs, who was the first black professor of anatomy, looked at the anatomical dissection in Cleveland, and he determined that whereas originally white bodies were used, later on Cleveland began importing the bodies of black people from the South. And a lot of physicians' memoirs and medical records validate the fact that there was quite a brisk business in moving the bodies of black people who had died to the North and to the West so that medical schools would have them for dissection.
And these were not shady physicians. These were prominent physicians of the day.
The Harvard Medical School professors, you know, discussed the fact that they have an arrangement. In fact, that was interesting. What I found was actually a series of letters during which they were complaining that the people who were supplying them with bodies from the South were trying to raise their rates. And they were protesting this, but finally conceded that they didn't think they had any choice because where else would they get their bodies? Eventually, Harvard moved its medical school from Cambridge, where most of the school is located, to Boston, so that they could be closer to their almshouse and closer to a source of cheap bodies.
And even today, I think you mentioned in your book that medical research institutions are certainly located somewhere nearby urban, I'll put that in quote, communities.
Right. Well, you know, they essentially, from the very beginning, we see they advertised in newspapers, because you have to remember that in the early period, there was no shame or no discomfort by being very frank about what they were doing. They would advertise, we're located in an area where there are a lot of black laborers. So if you come to our medical school, you'll have lots of black people to test, you'll have lots of black people to observe treatment on, and you'll have lots of black bodies to dissect. So after a while, of course, they were less open about why it was, but you see a consistent location of medical schools and emergency departments in black areas. And you can see that today. The catchment areas that they derive their patients from, even today, are often in black inner city areas.
I'm Bob Franklin. The program you're listening to is Like It Is. My guest today is Harriet A. Washington. She's the author of Medical Apartheid, the dark history of medical experimentation on Black Americans from colonial times to the present. Ms. Washington, why is this book important today? Why should readers read it, and why should the public know about it from your vantage point?
It's important for several reasons. First of all, although there is a great deal of bewailing the fact that African Americans don't participate in medical research, this is the first time anyone has set out to explain why, the historical roots of this aversion. It's also important because this is a historical vacuum. I read a great deal of medical history of medicine, everything. I mean, here and abroad, I know quite a few historians of medicine, and I've always been really surprised by the fact that although they tell the stories of many, many peoples, this is a story that has not been told comprehensively. Then finally, it's really important because this is a history that tends to be denied. Instead of looking at the history of medical research with Black people and how abusive it has been, what typically happens is people will mention the so-called Tuskegee syphilis study as if it were the only event, when people have raised other experimentation that they've heard of. The typical response is, oh, there's no evidence that that happened. So there's this tendency to deny the history, and this has had very severe consequences for African-American health. As I alluded to before, when the history is denied, this tends to reinforce people's fears, because Black people know that we have been abused in medical settings. And when we hear people deny this, well, I mean, that causes our fear or our aversion of medical systems to be even more deeply entrenched. My hope and publicizing this history, I'm laying the foundation for a dialogue. You know, now we'll be able to discuss it openly. Now we'll be able to address African-American fears, because one of the things I was careful to do was talk about what did and what didn't happen and try to dismiss some myths, that which are even worse than the things that actually happened.
It was interesting, to read how your initial book, or the idea of your book, was received by a professor at a medical school, and you had a conversation with her. Share with our audience how you were received by that particular medical professor, and what impression did it leave in your mind?
Well, you know, it's simply that. First, it was very interesting in that she evinced interest in the book, but before I could fully describe it to her, she began giving me the message I've just described, that, oh, none of these things happened. How can you write a book about something that didn't happen? And when I assured her that they did happen, and I told her what my, you know, resources had been, she began quizzing me closely about it, but she didn't really know anything about it, so she couldn't really ask pertinent questions. I found it really interesting that she didn't know anything about it. This is a professor whose syllabus had no information about African Americans. She had no interest in the topic. And yet, she felt she could naysay the topic without knowing anything about it. She was so sure none of this happened. So as I began to explain to her that it did happen and how I knew it, she quickly changed from saying it didn't happen to giving me a message I've heard frequently, which is that you can't write about this. You're going to make Black people afraid of medical care and medical research. Well, I explained that that's impossible. I cannot make Black people afraid of medical care and medical research. That's already been accomplished by the people whose abuses that I chronicle. But yet, it just showed me that there was going to be resistance, this kill the messenger mentality. There's just a great deal of resistance to anyone even writing about these events and about this history. So it didn't change anything I did, of course, except to make me more determined to write the book. But I think it's really important, and it's really important that sometimes some of the reaction to the book, the very small minority, thank goodness, most people, Black and white, appreciate the importance of the book, appreciate the need for the book, and the book has gotten almost universal glowing praise from all its reviewers, all except for one, as a matter of fact. But there is that mentality. There are those people who are very resistant to knowing this. And I think it's important to keep that in mind. However, that's the reason I documented the book the way I did. It's written for intelligent lay people, but I documented it for scholars.
How did you get on the trail of writing this book? What was the event, or what pushed you in the direction to write this book?
I didn't write the book until 2002. In the fall of 2002, I began a fellowship, a research fellowship in medical ethics at Harvard Medical School. And only then did I feel I had all the tools I needed to write the book. But the idea for the book came from a long time ago. Before I was a writer, before I considered writing the book, I knew I was concerned about it, and I knew someone had to write it, and I knew someone had to do something about it. And that was an experience I had when I was working in a hospital. I was running a poison control center at a teaching hospital in upstate New York, and we were given an old filing folder. And when I opened it, I found some old, forgotten medical files in it. The medical files were of two older gentlemen. They were both older and retired and insured, and they were both in kidney failure. The file folder for the white gentleman was huge. It was full of all kinds of sheafs of testing and reports, all the information that needed to be acquired in order to make him a candidate for a kidney transplant. And there's also a burgeoning social file on him. It stressed his loving family, his determination to live, and stressed why he would be an excellent candidate for a kidney transplant. The file of the black gentleman was very thin, only a few sheets. And every sheet had the word Negro stamped on it. The word Negro was underlined in his social profile right above the line that said that the medical staff's plan for him was not to obtain a kidney, but to help him to prepare for his imminent demise. So that was a staggering experience for me. And I thought, you know, why were they treated so differently? Was it a matter of race? You know, the obvious differences weren't there. It would be one thing if the black gentleman hadn't had insurance. You know, but I, you know, that question was haunting me. And from that moment, I began trying to answer this question. This was in the early 1980s, you know, long before much talk about, you know, health disparities. And so from that moment on, I began looking into how blacks and whites were treated differently by the medical system. And I found that the most dramatic differences happened in the medical research arena. And I also, at that time, I didn't know that no one had ever done a comprehensive history of it, but I did know from reading other books on medical history of medicine that there was very little attention paid to this. So I kept researching it because I was interested in the question, but not until 2002 that I decided for sure that I was going to write a book.
We have about 1 minute left. How much of a research effort was it to collect all of this data from medical journals and translating the medical jargon? How significant or how challenging was that?
Well, the medical jargon wasn't a problem for me because of my training, but in terms of collecting the information, I would say it was difficult. It took a lot of time, but I also enjoyed it a lot because I sensed I was making a contribution. I sensed I was filling a vacuum in our knowledge. So that inspired me. And it was interesting. It was actually quite exciting because I found data every place from Tuskegee, Alabama to, to Berlin, Germany. I was also in Frankfurt, Germany. I had lived in Germany as a child, so I had some experience there. And I found some old records about the disparate eugenic treatment of Afro-German men. And I thought, my goodness, this echoes exactly what was going on in the States at that time. So.
Well, we've had a stimulating, informative, educational discussion this morning with Harriet A. Washington. Her book, Medical Apartheid, The Dark History of Medical Experimentation on Black Americans from Colonial Times to the Present. Good luck with the book, Ms. Washington, and thank you for being a guest today on Like It Is.
Thank you so much, Dr. Franklin.
I'm Bob Franklin. I'll be back next week with 30 more minutes of good conversation on another edition of Like It Is.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.